sleep all night in his bed like a Christian man. Not again would he be tempted down the narrow way by a shadow with red lips and icy breath. Not again would he dream that dream of terror and delight. He was near the village now. It was half an hour since the sun had set, and the cracked church bell sent little discordant echoes across the rocks and ravines to tell all good people that the day was done. Angelo stood still a moment where the path forked, where it led toward the village on the left and down to the gorge on the right, where a clump of chestnut trees overhung the narrow way. He stood still a minute, lifting his battered hat from his head and gazing at the fast-fading sea westward, and his lips moved as he silently repeated the familiar evening prayer. His lips moved, but the words that followed them in his brain lost their meaning and turned into others and ended in a name that he spoke aloud. Christina. With the name, the tension of his will relaxed suddenly, reality went out, and the dream took him again, and bore him on swiftly and surely like a man walking in his sleep, down, down by the steep path in the gathering darkness. And as she glided beside him, Christina whispered strange, sweet things in his ear, which somehow, if he had been awake, he knew that he could not quite have understood. Now they were the most wonderful words he had ever heard in his life. And she kissed him also, but not upon his mouth. He felt her sharp kisses upon his white throat, and he knew that her lips were red. So the wild dream sped on through twilight and darkness and moonrise, and all the glory of the summer's night. But in the chilly dawn, he lay as one half dead upon the mound down there, recalling and not recalling, drained of his blood, yet strangely longing to give those red lips more. Then came the fear, the awful nameless panic, the mortal horror that guards the confines of the world we see not, neither know of as we know of other things, but which we feel when its icy chill freezes our bones and stirs our hair with the touch of a ghostly hand. Once more, Angelo sprang from the mound and fled up the gorge in the breaking day, but his step was less sure this time, and he panted for breath as he ran, and when he came to the bright spring of water that rises halfway up the hillside, he dropped upon his knees and hands and plunged his whole face in and drank as he had never drunk before. For it was the thirst of the wounded man who has lain bleeding all night long upon the battlefield. She had him fast now, and he could not escape her, but would come to her every evening at dusk until she had drained him of his last drop of blood. It was in vain that when the day was done he tried to take another turning and go home by a path that did not lead near the gorge. It was in vain that he made promises to himself each morning at dawn when he climbed the lonely way up from the shore to the village. It was all in vain, for when the sun sank burning into the sea, and the coolness of the evening stole out as from a hiding place to delight the weary world, his feet turned toward the old way, and she was waiting for him in the shadow under the chestnut trees. And then all happened as before, and she fell to kissing his white throat, even as she flitted lightly down the way, winding one arm about him. And as his blood failed, she grew more hungry and more thirsty every day. And every day when he awoke in the early dawn, it was harder to rouse himself to the effort of climbing the steep path to the village. And when he went to his work, his feet dragged painfully, and there was hardly strength in his arms to wield the heavy hoe. He scarcely spoke to anyone now, but the people said he was consuming himself for the love of the girl he was to have married when he lost his inheritance. And they laughed heartily at the thought, for this is not a very romantic country. At this time, Antonio, the man who stays here to look after the tower, returned from a visit to his people, who live near Salerno. He had been away all the time since before Ilario's death, and knew nothing of what had happened. He has told me that he came back late in the afternoon and shut himself up in the tower to eat and sleep, for he was very tired. It was past midnight when he awoke, and when he looked out, the waning moon was rising over the shoulder of the hill. He looked out toward the mound, and he saw something, and he did not sleep again that night. When he went out again in the morning, it was broad daylight, and there was nothing to be seen on the mound but loose stones and driven sand. Yet he did not go very near it. He went straight up the path to the village and directly to the house of the old priest. "I have seen an evil thing this night," he said. "I have seen how the dead drink the blood of the living, and the blood is the life."
"Tell me what you have seen," said the priest in reply.
Antonio told him everything he had seen.
"You must bring your book and your holy water tonight," he added. "I will be here before sunset to go down with you, and if it pleases your reverence to sup with me while we wait, I will make ready."
"I will come," the priest answered, "for I have read in old books of these strange beings which are neither quick nor dead, and which lie ever fresh in their graves, stealing out in the dust to taste life and blood."
Antonio cannot read, but he was glad to see that the priest understood the business, for of course, the books must have instructed him as to the best means of quieting the half-living thing forever.
So Antonio went away to his work, which consists largely in sitting on the shady side of the tower, when he is not perched upon a rock with a fishing line catching nothing. But on that day he went twice to look at the mound in the bright sunlight, and he searched round and round it for some hole through which the being might get in and out, but he found none. When the sun began to sink and the air was cooler in the shadows, he went up to fetch the old priest, carrying a little wicker basket with him, and in this they placed a bottle of holy water, and the basin, and sprinkler, and the stole which the priest would need, and they came down and waited in the door of the tower till it should be dark. But while the light still lingered very grey and faint, they saw something moving, just there, two figures, a man's that walked and a woman's that flitted beside him, and while her head lay on his shoulder she kissed his throat. The priest has told me that too, and that his teeth chattered and he grasped Antonio's arm. The vision passed and disappeared into the shadow. Then Antonio got the leathern flask of strong liquor, which he kept for great occasions, and poured such a draught as made the old man feel almost young again. And he got the lantern, and his pick and shovel, and gave the priest his stole to put on and the holy water to carry, and they went out together toward the spot where the work was to be done. Antonio says that in spite of the rum, his own knees shook together, and the priest stumbled over his Latin. For when they were yet a few yards from the mound, the flickering light of the lantern fell upon Angelo's white face, unconscious as if in sleep, and on his upturned throat, over which a very thin red line of blood trickled down into his collar, and the flickering light of the lantern played upon another face that looked up from the feast, upon two deep, dead eyes that saw in spite of death, upon parted lips redder than life itself, upon two gleaming teeth on which glistened a rosy drop. Then the priest, good old man, shut his eyes tight and showered holy water before him, and his cracked voice rose almost to a scream, and then Antonio, who is no coward after all, raised his pick in one hand and the lantern in the other as he sprang forward, not knowing what the end should be. And then he swears that he heard a woman's cry, and the thing was gone, and Angelo lay alone on the mound, unconscious, with the red line on his throat and the beads of deadly sweat on his cold forehead. They lifted him, half dead as he was, and laid him on the ground close by. Then Antonio went to work, and the priest helped him, though he was old and could not do much, and they dug deep, and at last Antonio, standing in the grave, stooped down with his lantern to see what he might see. His hair used to be dark brown, with grizzled streaks about the temples. In less than a month from that day, he was as grey as a badger. He was a miner when he was young, and most of these fellows have seen ugly sights now and then, when accidents have happened, but he had never seen what he saw that night. That thing that will abide neither above ground nor in the grave. Antonio had brought something with him which the priest had not noticed. He had made it that afternoon, a sharp stake shaped from a piece of tough old driftwood. He had it with him now, and he had his heavy pick, and he had taken the lantern down into the grave. I don't think any power on earth could make him speak of what happened then.
and the old priest was too frightened to look in. He says he heard Antonio breathing like a wild beast, and moving as if he were fighting with something almost as strong as himself. And he heard an evil sound also, with blows as of something violently driven through flesh and bone, and then the most awful sound of all, a woman's shriek, the unearthly scream of a woman neither dead nor alive, but buried deep for many days. And he, the poor old priest, could only rock himself as he knelt there in the sand, crying aloud his prayers and exorcisms to drown these dreadful sounds. Then suddenly, a small iron-bound chest was thrown up and rolled over against the old man's knee, and in a moment more Antonio was beside him, his face as white as tallow in the flickering light of the lantern, shoveling the sand and pebbles into the grave with furious haste, and looking over the edge till the pit was half full. And the priest said that there was much fresh blood on Antonio's hands and on his clothes. I had come to the end of my story. Holger finished his wine and leaned back in his chair. "So, Angelo got his own again," he said. "Did he marry the prim and plump young person to whom he had been betrothed?" "No, he had been badly frightened. He went to South America and has not been heard of since." "And that poor thing's body is still there, I suppose," said Holger. "Is it quite dead yet, I wonder?" "I wonder too. But whether it be dead or alive, I should hardly care to see it even in broad daylight." "Antonio is as grey as a badger, and he has never been quite the same man since that night."
Count Magnus by M.R. James. Montague Rhodes James, 1862-1936, was born in Kent and became Provost of King's College, Cambridge, 1905-1918, and Eton College, 1918-1936, gaining a worldwide reputation as a scholar. It is for his supernatural and macabre fiction that he is most remembered today, notably the ghost stories that he wrote and read to friends, distinguishing himself as a fine actor, as Christmas Eve entertainments. The BBC took the idea and filmed famed horror actor Christopher Lee reading the stories in a candlelit room in King's College. James's atmospheric ghost stories have a classic structure requiring certain elements: an old abbey, cathedral, university, or estate, usually in a remote village or seaside town, a quiet and naive gentleman scholar, an old book or other antiquarian object that calls down the wrath of a supernatural creature, usually from beyond the grave. For James, the ghost cannot be friendly or playful. It must be evil. He once wrote, "The ghost must be malevolent or odious. Amiable and helpful apparitions are all very well in fairy tales or in local legends, but I have no use for them in a fictitious ghost story." James's famous story, Casting the Runes, was filmed by Jacques Tourneur as Knight of the Demon, U.S. title Curse of the Demon, in 1957, a high point of British horror movies. Count Magnus was first published in Ghost Stories of an Antiquary, London, Edward Arnold, 1904.
Count Magnus by M.R. James. Read by Jonathan Cowley. By what means the papers out of which I have made a connected story came into my hands is the last point which the reader will learn from these pages. But it is necessary to prefix to my extracts from them a statement of the form in which I possess them. They consist, then, partly of a series of collections for a book of travels, such a volume as was a common product of the 40s and 50s. Horace Marryat's Journal of a Residence in Jutland and the Danish Isles is a fair specimen of the class to which I allude. These books usually treated of some unfamiliar district on the continent. They were illustrated with woodcuts or steel plates. They gave details of hotel accommodations and of means of communication, such as we now expect to find in any well-regulated guidebook, and they dealt largely in reported conversations with intelligent foreigners, racy innkeepers, and garrulous peasants. In a word, they were chatty. Begun with the idea of furnishing material for such a book, my My papers as they progressed assumed the character of a record of one single personal experience, and this record was continued up to the very eve, almost, of its termination. The writer was a Mr. Raxall. For my knowledge of him, I have to depend entirely on the evidence his writings afford. And from these, I deduce that he was a man past middle age, possessed of some private means, and very much alone in the world. He had, it seems, no settled abode in England, but was a denizen of hotels and boarding houses. It is probable that he entertained the idea of settling down at some future time, which never came. And I think it is also likely that the Pantechnicon fire in the early 70s must have destroyed a great deal that would have thrown light on his antecedents, for he refers once or twice to property of his that was warehoused at that establishment. It is further apparent that Mr. Raxall had published a book, and that it treated of a holiday he had once taken in Brittany. More than this I cannot say about his work, because a diligent search in bibliographical works has convinced me that it must have appeared either anonymously or under a pseudonym. As to his character, it is not difficult to form some superficial opinion. He must have been an intelligent and cultivated man. It seems that he was near being a fellow of his college at Oxford, Brasenose as I judge from the calendar. His besetting fault was pretty clearly that of over-inquisitiveness, possibly a good fault in a traveller, certainly a fault for which this traveller paid dearly enough in the end. On what proved to be his last expedition, he was plotting another book. Scandinavia, a region not widely known to Englishmen 40 years ago, had struck him as an interesting field. He must have lighted on some old books of Swedish history or memoirs, and the idea had struck him that there was room for a book descriptive of travel in Sweden, interspersed with episodes from the history of some of the great Swedish families. He procured letters of introduction, therefore, to some persons of quality in Sweden, and set out thither in the early summer of 1863. Of his travels in the north there is no need to speak, nor of his residence of some weeks in Stockholm. I need only mention that some savant resident there put him on the track of an important collection of family papers belonging to the proprietors of an ancient manor house in Vestergotland, and obtained for him permission to examine them. The manor house, or Herrgård, in question is to be called Råbäck, though that is not its name. It is one of the best buildings of its kind in all the country, and the picture of it in Dallenberg's Suecia Antique et Moderna, engraved in 1694, shows it very much as the tourist may see it today. It was built soon after 1600, and is, roughly speaking, very much like an English house of that period in respect of material, red brick with stone facings, and style. The man who built it was a scion of the great house of De la Gardie, and his descendants possess it still. De la Gardie is the name by which I will designate them when mention of them becomes necessary. They received Mr. Raxall with great kindness and courtesy, and pressed him to stay in the house as long as his researches lasted. But, preferring to be independent, and mistrusting his powers of conversing in Swedish, he settled himself at the village inn, which turned out quite sufficiently comfortable, at any rate during the summer months. This arrangement would entail a short walk daily to and from the manor house of something under a mile. The house itself stood in a park and was protected, we should say grown up, with large old timber. Near it you found the walled garden, and then entered a close wood fringing one of the small lakes with which the whole country is pitted. Then came the wall of the demesne, and you climbed a steep knoll, a knob of rock lightly covered with soil, and on top of this stood the church, fenced in with tall dark trees. It was a curious building to English eyes. The nave and aisles were low, and filled with pews and galleries. In the western gallery stood the handsome old organ, gaily painted and with silver pipes. The ceiling was flat, and had been adorned by a 17th-century artist with a strange and hideous Last Judgment, full of lurid flames, falling cities, burning ships, crying souls, and brown and smiling demons. Handsome brass coronae hung from the roof. The pulpit was like a doll's house, covered with little painted wooden cherubs and saints. A stand with three hourglasses was hinged to the preacher's desk. Such sights as these may be seen in many a church in Sweden now, but what distinguished this one was an addition to the original building. At the eastern end of the north aisle, the builder of the manor house had erected a mausoleum for himself and his family. It was a largish eight-sided building, lighted by a series of oval windows, and it had a domed roof, topped by a kind of pumpkin-shaped object rising into a spire, a form in which Swedish architects greatly delighted. The roof was of copper externally and was painted black, while the walls, in common with those of the church, were staringly white. To this mausoleum there was no access from the church. It had a portal and steps of its own on the northern side. Past the churchyard the path to the village goes, and not more than 3 or 4 minutes bring you to the inn door. On the first day of his stay at Roebuck, Mr. Raxall found the church door open, and made those notes of the interior which I have epitomised. Into the mausoleum, however, he could not make his way. He could, by looking through the keyhole, just descry that there were fine marble effigies and sarcophagi of copper, and a wealth of armorial ornament, which made him very anxious to spend some time in investigation. The papers he had come to examine at the manor house proved to be of just the kind he wanted for his book. There were family correspondence, journals, and account books of the earliest owners of the estate, very carefully kept and clearly written, full of amusing and picturesque detail. The first De la Gardie appeared in them as a strong and capable man. Shortly after the building of the mansion there had been a period of distress in the district, and the peasants had risen and attacked several chateaux and done some damage. The owner of Roebuck took a leading part in suppressing the trouble, and there was reference to executions of ringleaders and severe punishments inflicted with no sparing hand. The portrait of this Magnus De la Gardie was one of the best in the house, and Mr. Raxall studied it with no little interest after his day's work. He gives no detailed description of it, but I gather that the face impressed him rather by its strength than by its beauty or goodness. In fact, he writes that Count Magnus was an almost phenomenally ugly man. On this day, Mr. Raxall took his supper with the family and walked back in the late but still bright evening. "I must remember," he writes, "to ask the sexton if he can let me into the mausoleum at the church. He evidently has access to it himself, for I saw him tonight standing on the steps, and, as I thought, locking or unlocking the door." I find that early on the following day, Mr. Raxall had some conversation with his landlord. His setting it down at such length as he does surprised me at first, but I soon realise that the papers I was reading were, at least in their beginning, the materials for the book he was meditating, and that it was to have been one of those quasi-journalistic productions which admit of the introduction of an admixture of conversational matter. His object, he says, was to find out whether any traditions of Count Magnus De la Gardie lingered on in the scenes of that gentleman's activity, and whether the popular estimate of him were favourable or not. He found that the Count was decidedly not a favourite. If his tenants came late to their work on the days which they owed to him as Lord of the Manor, they were set on the wooden horse or flogged and branded in the manor house yard. One or two cases there were of men who had occupied lands which encroached on the Lord's domain, and whose houses had been mysteriously burnt on a winter's night with the whole family inside. But what seemed to dwell on the innkeeper's mind most, for he returned to the subject more than once, was that the Count had been on the Black Pilgrimage and had brought something or someone back with him. You will naturally inquire, as Mr. Raxall did, what the Black Pilgrimage may have been. But your curiosity on the point must remain unsatisfied for the time being, just as his did. The landlord was evidently unwilling to give a full answer, or indeed any answer on the point, and, being called out for a moment, trotted off with obvious alacrity, only putting his head in at the door a few minutes afterwards to say that he was called away to Skara, and should not be back till evening. so Mr. Raxall had to go unsatisfied to his day's work at the manor house. The papers on which he was just then engaged soon put his thoughts into another channel, for he had to occupy himself with glancing over the correspondence between Sophia Albertina in Stockholm and her married cousin Ulrika Leonora at Roebuck, in the years 1705 to 1710. The letters were of exceptional interest from the light they threw upon the culture of that period in Sweden, as anyone can testify who has read the full edition of them in the publications of the Swedish Historical Manuscripts Commission. In the afternoon he had done with these, and after returning the boxes in which they were kept to their places on the shelf, he proceeded, very naturally, to take down some of the volumes nearest to them, in order to determine which of them had best be his principal subject of investigation next day. The shelf he had hit upon was occupied mostly by a collection of account books in the writing of the first Count Magnus. But one among them was not an account book, but a book of alchemical and other tracts in another 16th century hand. Not being very familiar with alchemical literature, Mr. Raxall spends much space which he might have spared in setting out the names and beginnings of the various treatises. The Book of the Phoenix, Book of the 30 Words, Book of the Toad, Book of Miriam, Turba Philosophorum, and so forth. And then he announces with a good deal of circumstance his delight at finding, on a leaf originally left blank near the middle of the book, some writing of Count Magnus himself headed Liber Nigrae Peregrinationis. It is true that only a few lines were written, but there was quite enough to show that the landlord had that morning been referring to a belief at least as old as the time of Count Magnus, and probably shared by him. This is the English of what was written. If any man desires to obtain a long life, if he would obtain a faithful messenger and see the blood of his enemies, it is necessary that he should first go into the city of Chorazin, and there salute the prince. Here there was an erasure of one word, not very thoroughly done, so that Mr. Raxall felt pretty sure that he was right in reading it as heiress of the heir. But there was no more of the text copied, only a line in Latin. Quare reliqua hujus materiae inter secretiora. See the rest of this matter among the more private things. It could not be denied that this threw a rather lurid light upon the tastes and beliefs of the Count, but to Mr. Raxall, separated from him by nearly three centuries, the thought that he might have added to his general forcefulness alchemy, and to alchemy something like magic, only made him a more picturesque figure, and when, after a rather prolonged contemplation of his picture in the hall, Mr. Raxall set out on his homeward way, his mind was full of the thought of Count Magnus. He had no eyes for his surroundings, no perception of the evening scents of the woods or the evening light on the lake, and when all of a sudden he pulled up short, he was astonished to find himself already at the gate of the churchyard, and within a few minutes of his dinner. His eyes fell on the mausoleum. "Ah," he said, "Count Magnus, there you are. I should dearly like to see you." "Like many solitary men," he writes, "I have a habit of talking to myself aloud, and, unlike some of the Greek and Latin particles, I do not expect an answer." Certainly, and perhaps fortunately in this case, there was neither voice nor any that regarded. Only the woman who, I suppose, was cleaning up the church, dropped some metallic object on the floor, whose clang startled me. Count Magnus, I think, sleeps sound enough. That same evening the landlord of the inn, who had heard Mr. Raxall say that he wished to see the clerk or deacon, as he would be called in Sweden, of the parish, introduced him to that official in the inn parlour. A visit to the De la Gardie tomb house was soon arranged for the next day, and a little general conversation ensued. Mr. Raxall, remembering that one function of Scandinavian deacons is to teach candidates for confirmation, thought he would refresh his own memory on a biblical point. "Can you tell me," he said, "anything about Chorazin?" The deacon seemed startled, but readily reminded him how that village had once been denounced. "To be sure," said Mr. Raxall, It is, I suppose, quite a ruin now?
So I expect, replied the deacon. I have heard some of our old priests say that Antichrist is to be born there, and there are tales.
Ah, what tales are those? Mr. Wraxall put in.
Tales I was going to say, which I have forgotten, said the deacon, and soon after that he said good night.
The landlord was now alone, and at Mr. Wraxall's mercy, and that inquirer was not inclined to spare him.
Herr Nielsen, he said, I have found out something about the Black Pilgrimage. You may as well tell me what you know. What did the Count bring back with him?
Swedes are habitually slow, perhaps in answering, or perhaps the landlord was an exception. I am not sure, but Mr. Wraxall notes that the landlord spent at least 1 minute in looking at him before he said anything at all. Then he came close up to his guest, and with a good deal of effort he spoke.
Mr. Wraxall, I can tell you this one little tale, and no more, not any more. You must not ask anything when I have done. In my grandfather's time, that is, 92 years ago, there were two men who said, The Count is dead. We do not care for him. We will go tonight and have a free hunt in his wood. The long wood on the hill that you have seen behind Roebuck. Well, those that heard them say this. They said, No, do not go. We are sure you will meet with persons walking who should not be walking. They should be resting, not walking. These men laughed. There were no forest men to keep the wood, because no one wished to hunt there. The family were not here at the house. These men could do what they wished.
Very well, they go to the wood that night. My grandfather was sitting here in this room. It was the summer and a light night. With the window open, he could see out to the wood and hear. So he sat there, and two or three men with him, and they listened. At first they hear nothing at all. Then they hear someone. You know how far away it is. They hear someone scream, just as if the most inside part of his soul was twisted out of him. All of them in the room caught hold of each other, and they sat so for 3/4 of an hour. Then they hear someone else, only about 300 ells off. They hear him laugh out loud. It was not one of those two men that laughed, and indeed, they have all of them said that it was not any man at all. After that they hear a great door shut. Then, when it was just light with the sun, they all went to the priest. They said to him, Father, put on your gown and your ruff, and come to bury these men. Anders Bjornsson and Hans Thorbjorn. You understand that they were sure that these men were dead. So they went to the wood. My grandfather never forgot this. He said they were all like so many dead men themselves. The priest, too, he was in a white fear. He said when they came to him, I heard one cry in the night, and I heard one laugh afterwards. If I cannot forget that, I shall not be able to sleep again. So they went to the wood, and they found those men on the edge of the wood. Hans Thorbjorn was standing with his back against a tree, and all the time he was pushing with his hands, pushing something away from him which was not there, so he was not dead. And they led him away, and took him to the house at Nykjoping, and he died before the winter, but he went on pushing with his hands. Also, Anders Bjornsson was there, but he was dead. And I tell you this about Anders Bjornsson, that he was once a beautiful man, but now his face was not there, because the flesh of it was sucked away off the bones. You understand that? My grandfather did not forget that. And they laid him on the bier, which they brought, and they put a cloth over his head. And the priest walked before, and they began to sing the psalm for the dead as well as they could. So as they were singing the end of this first verse, one fell down, who was carrying the head of the bier, and the others looked back, and they saw that the cloth had fallen off, and the eyes of Anders Bjornsson were looking up, because there was nothing to close over them. And this they could not bear. Therefore the priest laid the cloth upon him and sent for a spade, and they buried him in that place. The next day Mr. Wraxall records that the deacon called for him soon after his breakfast and took him to the church and mausoleum. He noticed that the key of the latter was hung on a nail just by the pulpit, and it occurred to him that as the church door seemed to be left unlocked as a rule, it would not be difficult for him to pay a second and more private visit to the monuments if there could be proved to be more of interest among them than could be digested at first. The building, when he entered it, he found not unimposing. The monuments, mostly large erections of the 17th and 18th centuries, were dignified if luxuriant, and the epitaphs and heraldry were copious. The central space of the dome room was occupied by three copper sarcophagi, covered with finely engraved ornament. Two of them had, as is commonly the case in Denmark and Sweden, a large metal crucifix on the lid. The third, that of Count Magnus, as it appeared, had, instead of that, a full-length effigy engraved upon it, and round the edge were several bands of similar ornament representing various scenes. One was a battle, with cannon belching out smoke, and walled towns and troops of pikemen. Another showed an execution. In a third, among trees, was a man running at full speed, with flying hair and outstretched hands. After him followed a strange form. It would be hard to say whether the artist had intended it for a man, and was unable to give the requisite similitude, or whether it was intentionally made as monstrous as it looked. In view of the skill with which the rest of the drawing was done, Mr. Raxall felt inclined to adopt the latter idea. The figure was unduly short, and was for the most part muffled in a hooded garment which swept the ground. The only part of the form which projected from the shelter was not shaped like any hand or arm. Mr. Raxall compares it to the tentacle of a devilfish and continues, "On seeing this, I said to myself, this then, which is evidently an allegorical representation of some kind, a fiend pursuing a hunted soul, may be the origin of the story of Count Magnus and his mysterious companion. Let us see how the huntsman is pictured. Doubtless it will be a demon blowing his horn." But as it turned out, there was no such sensational figure, only the semblance of a cloaked man on a hillock, who stood leaning on a stick, and watching the hunt with an interest which the engraver had tried to express in his attitude. Mr. Raxall noted the finely worked and massive steel padlocks, three in number, which secured the sarcophagus. One of them, he saw, was detached and lay on the pavement. And then, unwilling to delay the deacon longer or to waste his own working time, he made his way onward to the manor house. "It is curious," he notes, "how on retracing a familiar path, one's thoughts engross one to the absolute exclusion of surrounding objects. Tonight, for the second time, I had entirely failed to notice where I was going. I had planned a private visit to the tomb house to copy the epitaphs. When I suddenly, as it were, awoke to consciousness and found myself, as before, turning in at the churchyard gate, and, I believe, singing or chanting some such words as, 'Are you awake, Count Magnus? Are you asleep, Count Magnus?' and then something more which I have failed to recollect. It seemed to me that I must have been behaving in this nonsensical way for some time." He found the key of the mausoleum where he had expected to find it, and copied the greater part of what he wanted. In fact, he stayed until the light began to fail him. "I must have been wrong," he writes, "in saying that one of the padlocks of my count's sarcophagus was unfastened. I see tonight that two are loose. I picked both up and laid them carefully on the window ledge, after trying unsuccessfully to close them. The remaining one is still firm, and, though I take it to be a spring lock, I cannot guess how it is opened. Had I succeeded in undoing it, I am almost afraid I should have taken the liberty of opening the sarcophagus. It is strange the interest I feel in the personality of this, I fear somewhat ferocious and grim old noble." The day following was, as it turned out, the last of Mr. Raxall's stay at Roebuck. He received letters connected with certain investments which made it desirable that he should return to England. His work among the papers was practically done, and travelling was slow. He decided, therefore, to make his farewells, put some finishing touches to his notes, and be off. Those finishing touches and farewells, as it turned out, took more time than he had expected. The hospitable family insisted on his staying to dine with them. They dined at 3, and it was verging on 6:30 before he was outside the iron gates of Roebuck. He dwelt on every step of his walk by the lake, determined to saturate himself, now that he trod it for the last time, in the sentiment of the place and hour. And when he reached the summit of the churchyard knoll, he lingered for many minutes, gazing at the limitless prospect of woods near and distant, all dark beneath a sky of liquid green. When at last he turned to go, the thought struck him that surely he must bid farewell to Count Magnus, as well as the rest of the De Lagardis. The church was but 20 yards away, and he knew where the key of the mausoleum hung. It was not long before he was standing over the great copper coffin, and, as usual, talking to himself aloud. "You may have been a bit of a rascal in your time, Magnus," he was saying, "but for all that I should like to see you, or rather..." Just at that instant, he says, "I felt a blow on my foot. Hastily enough I drew it back, and something fell on the pavement with a clash. It was the third, the last of the three padlocks which had fastened the sarcophagus. I stooped to pick it up, and, heaven is my witness that I am writing only the bare truth, before I had raised myself there was a sound of metal hinges creaking, and I distinctly saw the lid shifting upwards. I may have behaved like a coward, but I could not for my life stay for one moment. I was outside that dreadful building in less time than I can write, almost as quickly as I could have said the words, and what frightens me yet more, I could not turn the key in the lock. As I sit here in my room noting these facts, I ask myself, it was not 20 minutes ago, whether that noise of creaking metal continued, and I cannot tell whether it did or not. I only know that there was something more than I have written that alarmed me, but whether it was sound or sight, I am not able to remember. What is this that I have done? Poor Mr. Wraxall. He set out on his journey to England on the next day, as he had planned, and he reached England in safety, and yet, as I gather from his changed hand and inconsequent jottings, a broken man. One of several small notebooks that have come to me with his papers gives, not a key to, but a kind of inkling of, his experiences. Much of his journey was made by canal boat, and I find not less than 6 painful attempts to enumerate and describe his fellow passengers. The entries are of this kind. 24. Pastor of village in Sven. Usual black coat and soft black hat. 25. Commercial traveller from Stockholm going to Trollhättan. Black cloak, brown hat. 26. Man in long black cloak, broad-leafed hat. Very old-fashioned. This entry is lined out and a note added, perhaps identical with number 13. Have not yet seen his face. On referring to number 13, I find that he is a Roman priest in a cassock. The net result of the reckoning is always the same. 28 people appear in the enumeration, one being always a man in a long black cloak and broad hat, and the other a short figure in a dark cloak and hood. On the other hand, it is always noted that only 26 passengers appear at meals, and that the man in the cloak is perhaps absent, and the short figure is certainly absent. On reaching England, it appears that Mr. Wraxall landed at Harwich, and that he resolved at once to put himself out of the reach of some person or persons whom he never specifies, but whom he had evidently come to regard as his pursuers. Accordingly, he took a vehicle, it was a closed fly, not trusting the railway, and drove across country to the village of Belchamp St. Paul. It was about 9 o'clock on a moonlight August night when he neared the place. He was sitting forward and looking out the window at the fields and thickets. There was little else to be seen racing past him. Suddenly he came to a crossroad. At the corner, 2 figures were standing motionless. Both were in dark cloaks. The taller one wore a hat, the shorter a hood. He had no time to see their faces, nor did they make any motion that he could discern. Yet the horse shied violently and broke into a gallop, and Mr. Wraxall sank back into his seat in something like desperation. He had seen them before. Arrived at Belchamp St. Paul, he was fortunate enough to find a decent furnished lodging, and for the next 24 hours he lived, comparatively speaking, in peace. His last notes were written on this day. They are too disjointed and ejaculatory to be given here in full, but the substance of them is clear enough. he is expecting a visit from his pursuers. How or when he knows not. And his constant cry is, "What has he done?" And, "Is there no hope?" Doctors he knows would call him mad. Policemen would laugh at him. The parson is away. What can he do but lock his door and cry to God? People still remembered last year at Belchamp St. Paul how a strange gentleman came one evening in August years back, and how the next morning but one he was found dead, and there was an inquest, and the jury that viewed the body fainted. 7 of them did, and none of them wouldn't speak of what they see, and the verdict was visitation of God, and how the people as Kep House moved out that same week and went away from that part. But they do not, I think, know that any glimmer of light has been thrown or could be thrown on the mystery. It so happened that last year the little house came into my hands as part of a legacy. It had stood empty since 1863, and there seemed no prospect of letting it, so I had it pulled down, and the papers of which I have given you an abstract were found in a forgotten cupboard under the window in the best bedroom.
When It Was Moonlight by Manly Wade Wellman. Manly Wade Wellman moved to North Carolina in 1955 and remained there for the rest of his life, becoming an expert in mountain music, the Civil War, and the historic regions and peoples of the Old South, and writing numerous nonfiction books on those subjects, including Dead and Gone, Classic Crimes of North Carolina, 1954, which won the Edgar Allan Poe Award from the Mystery Writers of America for Best Fact Crime Book, They Took Their Stand, The Founders of the Confederacy, 1959, and The Rebel Songster, Songs the Confederates Sang, 1959. He also wrote 14 children's books. Wellman's short story, A Star for a Warrior, won the Best Story of the Year award from Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine in 1946, beating out William Faulkner, who wrote an angry letter of protest. Other major honors include Lifetime Achievement Awards from the World Fantasy Convention, 1980, and the British Fantasy Society, 1986, and the World Fantasy Award for Best Collection for Worse Things Waiting, 1975. Several of Wellman's stories have been adapted for television, including The Valley Was Still for The Twilight Zone, 1961, The Devil Is Not Mocked for Night Gallery, 1971, and Laro's Catch Meddlers, 1951, and School for the Unspeakable, 1952, for Lights Out. When It Was Moonlight was originally published in the February 1940 issue of Unknown Worlds.
When It Was Moonlight by Manly Wade Wellman. Read by Ryan Gazelle. Let my heart be still a moment, and this mystery explore. The Raven. His hand, as slim as a white claw, dipped a quill full of ink and wrote in one corner of the page the date 3rd March, 1842. Then, The Premature Burial by Edgar A. Poe. He hated his middle name, the name of his miserly and spiteful stepfather. For a moment, he considered crossing out even the initial, then he told himself that he was only wool-gathering, putting off the drudgery of writing. And write he must, or starve. The Philadelphia Dollar newspaper was clamoring for the story he had promised. Well, today, he had heard a tag of gossip, his mother-in-law had it from a neighbor, that revived in his mind a subject always fascinating. He began rapidly to write, in a fine copperplate hand. There are certain themes of which the interest is all-absorbing, but which are entirely too horrible for the purposes of legitimate fiction. This would really be an essay, not a tale, and he could do it justice. Often he thought of the whole world as a vast, fat cemetery, close set with tombs in which not all the occupants were at rest. Too many struggled unavailingly against their smothering shrouds, their locked and weighted coffin lids. What were his own literary labors, he mused, but a struggle against being shut down and throttled by a society as heavy and grim and senseless as clods heaped by a sexton's spade? He paused and went to the slate mantel shelf for a candle. His kerosene lamp had long ago been pawned, and it was dark for mid-afternoon, even in March. Elsewhere in the house, his mother-in-law swept busily, and in the room next to his sounded the quiet breathing of his invalid wife. Poor Virginia slept, and for the moment knew no pain. Returning with his light, he dipped more ink and continued down the sheet. To be buried while alive is, beyond question, the most terrific of these extremes which has ever fallen to the lot of mere mortality. That it has frequently, very frequently, fallen will scarcely be denied. Again, his dark imagination savored the tale he had heard that day. It had happened here in Philadelphia, in this very quarter, less than a month ago. A widower had gone, after weeks of mourning, to his wife's tomb with flowers, stooping to place them on the marble slab he had heard noise beneath. At once joyful and aghast, he fetched men and crowbars and recovered the body, all untouched by decay. At home that night, the woman returned to consciousness. So said the gossip, perhaps exaggerated, perhaps not. And the house was only 6 blocks away from Spring Garden Street, where he sat. Poe fetched out his notebooks and began to marshal bits of narrative for his composition. A gloomy tale of resurrection in Baltimore, another from France, a genuinely creepy citation from the Chirurgical Journal of Leipzig. A sworn case of revival by electrical impulses of a dead man in London. Then he added an experience of his own, romantically embellished, a dream adventure of his boyhood in Virginia. Just as he thought to make an end, he had a new inspiration. Why not learn more about that reputed Philadelphia burial and the one who rose from seeming death? It would point up his piece, give it a timely local climax, ensure acceptance. He could hardly risk a rejection. Two, it would satisfy his own curiosity. Laying down the pen, Poe got up. From a peg he took his wide black hat, his old military cloak that he had worn since his ill-fated cadet days at West Point. Huddling it around his slim little body, he opened the front door and went out. March had come in like a lion, and lion-like roared and rampaged over Philadelphia. Dry, cold dust blew up into Poe's full gray eyes, and he hardened his mouth under the gay, dark mustache. His shins felt goose-fleshy. His striped trousers were unseasonably thin, and his shoes badly needed mending. Which way lay his journey? He remembered the name of the street and something about a ruined garden. Eventually he came to the place, or what must be the place. The garden was certainly ruined, full of dry, hardy weeds that still stood in great ragged clumps after the hard winter. Poe forced open the creaky gate, went up the rough, flagged path to the stoop. He saw a bronzed nameplate. Gauber, it said. Yes, that was the name he had heard. He swung the knocker loudly and thought he caught a whisper of movement inside, but the door did not open. "Nobody lives there, Mr. Poe," said someone from the street. It was a grocery boy. With a heavy basket on his arm, Poe left the doorstep. He knew the lad. Indeed, he owed the grocer $11. "Are you sure?" Poe prompted. "Well," and the boy shifted the weight of his burden, "if anybody lived there, they'd buy from our shop, wouldn't they? And I'd deliver, wouldn't I? But I've had this job for 6 months and never set foot inside that door." Poe thanked him and walked down the street, but did not take the turn that would lead home. Instead, he sought the shop of one Pemberton, a printer and friend, to pass the time of day and ask for a loan. Pemberton could not lend even $1. Times were hard, but offered a drink of Monongahela whiskey, which Poe forced himself to refuse, then a supper of crackers, cheese, and garlic sausage, which Poe thankfully shared. At home, unless his mother-in-law had begged or borrowed from the neighbors, would be only bread and molasses. It was past sundown when the rider shook hands with Pemberton, thanked him with warm courtesy for his hospitality, and ventured into the evening. Thank heaven it did not rain. Poe was saddened by storms. The wind abated and the March sky was clear, save for a tiny fluff of scudding cloud and a banked dark line at the horizon. While up rose a full moon the color of frozen cream. Poe squinted from under his hat brim at the shadow pattern on the disc. Might he not write another story of a lunar voyage, like the one about Han's fall, but dead serious this time? Musing thus, he walked along the dusk-filling street until he came again opposite the ruined garden, the creaky gate, and the house with the doorplate marked Gauber. Hello, the grocery boy had been wrong. There was light inside the front window. Water blue light. Or was there? Anyway, motion, yes, a figure stooped there as if to peer out at him. Poe turned in at the gate and knocked at the door once again. 4 or 5 moments of silence. Then he heard the old lock grating. The door moved inwards, slowly and noisily. Poe fancied that he had been wrong about the blue light, for he saw only darkness inside. A voice spoke.
"Well, sir."
The two words came huskily but softly, as though the door opener scarcely breathed. Poe swept off his broad black hat and made one of his graceful bows. "If you will pardon me," he paused, not knowing whether he addressed man or woman, "this is the Garber residence?"
"It is,"
was the reply, soft, hoarse, and sexless.
"Your business, sir?"
Poe spoke with official crispness. He had been a sergeant major of artillery before he was 21 and knew how to inject the proper note. "I am here on public duty," he announced. "I am a journalist, tracing a strange report."
"Journalist," repeated his interrogator. "Strange report? Come in, sir."
Poe complied, and the door closed abruptly behind him with a rusty snick of the lock. He remembered being in jail once, and how the door of his cell had slammed just so. It was not a pleasant memory, but he saw more clearly now he was inside. His eyes got used to the tiny trickle of moonlight. He stood in a dark hallway, all paneled in wood, with no furniture, drapes, or pictures. With him was a woman, in full skirt and down-drawn lace cap, a woman as tall as he and with intent eyes that glowed as from within. She neither moved nor spoke, but waited for him to tell her more of his errand. Poe did so, giving his name and, stretching a point, claiming to be a sub-editor of the Dollar newspaper, definitely assigned to the interview. "And now, madam, concerning this story that is rife, concerning a premature burial." She had moved very close, but as his face turned towards her, she drew back. Poe fancied that his breath had blown her away like a feather, then remembering Pemberton's garlic sausage, he was chagrined. To confirm his new thought, the woman was offering him wine to sweeten his breath.
"Would you take a glass of canary, Mr. Poe?"
she invited, and opened a side door. He followed her into a room papered in pale blue. Moonglow drenching it reflected from that paper and seemed an artificial light. That was what he had seen from outside. From an undraped table, his hostess lifted a bottle, poured wine into a metal goblet, and offered it. Poe wanted that wine, but he had recently promised his sick wife, solemnly and honestly, to abstain from even a sip of the drink that so easily upset him. Through thirsty lips, he said, "I thank you kindly, but I am a temperance man."
"Oh,"
and she smiled. Poe saw white teeth, then,
"I am Elva Garber, Mrs. John Garber. The matter of which you ask, I cannot explain clearly, but it is true. My husband was buried in the Eastern Lutheran churchyard."
"I had heard, Mrs. Garber, that the burial concerned a woman."
"No, my husband. He had been ill. He felt cold and quiet. A physician, a Dr. Metcham, pronounced him dead, and he was interred beneath a marble slab in his family vault."
She sounded weary, but her voice was calm.
"This happened shortly after the New Year. On Valentine's Day, I brought flowers. Beneath his slab he stirred and struggled. I had him brought forth, and he lives, after a fashion, today."
"Lives today?" repeated Poe. "In this house?"
"Would you care to see him? Interview him?"
Poe's heart raced, his spine chilled. It was his peculiarity that such sensations gave him pleasure. "I would like nothing better," he assured her, and she went to another door, an inner one. Opening it, she paused on the threshold, as though summoning her resolution for a plunge into cold, swift water. Then she started down a flight of steps. Poe followed, unconsciously drawing the door shut behind him. The gloom of midnight, of prison, yes, of the tomb, fell at once upon those stairs. He heard Elva Garber gasp,
"No, the moonlight, let it in!"
And then she fell, heavily and limply rolling downstairs. Aghast, Poe quickly groped his way after her. She lay against a door at the foot of the flight, wedged against the panel. He touched her. She was cold and rigid, without motion or elasticity of life. His thin hand groped for and found the knob of the lower door, flung it open. More dim reflected moonlight, and he made shift to drag the woman into it. Almost at once she sighed heavily, lifted her head, and rose.
"How stupid of me,"
she apologized hoarsely. "The fault was mine," protested Poe. "Your nerves, your health, have naturally suffered. The sudden dark, the closeness, overcame you." He fumbled in his pocket for a tinder box. "Suffer me to strike a light." But she held out a hand to stop him.
"No, no, the moon is sufficient."
She walked to a small, oblong pane set in the wall. Her hands, thin as Poe's own, with long, grubby nails hooked on the sill. Her face, bathed in the full light of the moon, strengthened and grew calm. She breathed deeply, almost voluptuously.
"I am quite recovered," she said. "Do not fear for me. You need not stand so near, sir."
He had forgotten that garlic odor and drew back contritely. She must be as sensitive to the smell as... What was it that was sickened and driven by garlic? Poe could not remember, and he took time to note that they were in a basement, stone-walled and with a floor of dirt. In one corner, water seemed to drip, forming a dank pool of mud. Close to this, set into the wall, showed a latched trap door of planks, thick and wide, cleated crosswise as though to cover a window. But no window would be set so low. Everything smelt earthy and close, as though fresh air had been shut out for decades.
"Your husband is here?" he inquired. "Yes."
She walked to the shutter-like trap, unlatched it, and drew it open. The recess beyond was as black as ink, and from it came a feeble mutter. Poe followed Elva Gauber and strained his eyes. In a little stone-flagged nook, a bed had been made up. Upon it lay a man, stripped almost naked. His skin was as white as dead bone, and only his eyes, now opening, had life. He gazed at Elva Gauber and passed her at Poe.
"Go away," he mumbled.
"Sir," ventured Poe formally, "I have come to hear of how you came to life in the grave."
"It's a lie,"
broke in the man on the pallet. He writhed halfway to a sitting posture, laboring upwards as against a crushing weight. The wash of moonlight showed how wasted and fragile he was. His face stared and snarled, bare-toothed like a skull.
"A lie, I say,"
he cried with a sudden strength that might well have been his last,
"told by this monster who is not my wife."
The shutter trap slammed upon his cries. Elva Gauber faced Poe, withdrawing a pace to avoid his garlic breath.
"You have seen my husband," she said. "Was it a pretty sight, sir?"
He did not answer, and she moved across the dirt to the stair doorway.
"Will you go up first?" she asked. "At the top, hold the door open that I may have..."
She said, "life," or perhaps "light." Poe could not be sure which. Plainly, she, who had almost welcomed his intrusion at first, now sought to lead him away. Her eyes, compelling as shouted commands, were fixed upon him. He felt their power and bowed to it. Obediently, he mounted the stairs and stood with the upper door wide open. Elva Gauber came up after him. At the top, her eyes seized his. Suddenly, Poe knew more than ever about the mesmeric impulses he loved to write about.
"I hope," she said measuredly, "that you have not found your mission fruitless. I live here alone, seeing nobody, caring for the poor thing that was once my husband, John Gauber. My mind is not clear. Perhaps my manners are not good. Forgive me, and good night."
Poe found himself ushered from the house, and outside the wind was howling again. The front door closed behind him, and the lock grated. The fresh air, the whip of gale in his face, and the absence of Elba Gauber's impelling gaze suddenly brought him back, as though from sleep, to a realization of what had happened. Or what had not happened. He had come out on this uncomfortable March evening to investigate the report of a premature burial. He had seen a ghastly thing that had called the gossip a lie. Somehow, then, he had been drawn abruptly away, stopped from full study of what might be one of the strangest adventures it was ever a writer's good fortune to know. Why was he letting things drop at this stage? He decided not to let them drop. That would be worse than staying away altogether. He made up his mind, formed quickly a plan. Leaving the doorstep, he turned from the gate, slipped quickly around the house. He knelt by the foundation at the side, just where a small oblong pane was set flush with the ground. Bending his head, he found that he could see plainly inside by reason of the flood of moonlight, a phenomenon, he realized, for generally an apartment was disclosed only by light within. The open doorway to the stairs, the swamp mess of mud in the corner, the outflung trap door were discernible, and something stood or huddled at the exposed niche. Something that bent itself upon and above the frail white body of John Gauber. Full skirt, white cap, it was Elva Gauber. She bent herself down. Her face was touching the face or shoulder of her husband. Poe's heart, never the healthiest of organs, began to drum and race. He pressed closer to the pane for a better glimpse of what went on in the cellar. His shadow cut away some of the light. Elva Gauber turned to look. Her face was as pale as the moon itself. Like the moon, it was shadowed in irregular patches. She came quickly, almost running towards the pane where Poe crouched. He saw her plainly and at close hand. Dark, wet, sticky stains lay upon her mouth and cheeks. Her tongue roved out, licking at the stains. Blood. Poe sprang up and ran to the front of the house. He forced his thin, trembling fingers to seize the knocker, to swing it heavily again and again. When there was no answer, he pushed heavily against the door itself. It did not give. He moved to a window, rapped on it, pried at the sill, lifted his fist to smash the glass. A silhouette moved beyond the pane and threw it up. Something shot out at him, like a pale snake striking. Before he could move back, fingers had twisted in the front of his coat. Elva Gauber's eyes glared into his. Her cap was off, her dark hair fallen in disorder, blood still smeared and dewed her mouth and jowls. "You have pried too far," she said, in a voice as measured and cold as the drip from icicles. "I was going to spare you because of the odor about you that repelled me, the garlic. I showed you a little, enough to warn any wise person, and let you go now." Poe struggled to free himself. Her grip was immovable, like the clutch of a steel trap. She grimaced in triumph, yet she could not quite face him. The garlic still clung to his breath. "Look in my eyes," she bade him. "Look. You cannot refuse. You cannot escape. You will die with John, and the two of you, dying, shall rise again like me. I'll have two fountains of life while you remain, two companions after you die." "Woman," said Poe, fighting against her stabbing gaze, "you are mad." She snickered gustily. "I am sane, and so are you. We both know that I speak the truth. We both know the futility of your struggle." Her voice rose a little. "Through a chink in the tomb, as I lay dead, a ray of moonlight streamed and struck my eyes. I woke. I struggled. I was set free. Now, at night, when the moon shines... Ah! Don't breathe that herb in my face." She turned her head away. At that instant, it seemed to Poe that a curtain of utter darkness fell, and with it sank down the form of Elva Gauber. He peered into the sudden gloom. She was collapsed across the windowsill, like a discarded puppet in its booth. Her hand still twisted in the bosom of his coat, and he pried himself loose from it, finger by steely cold finger. Then he turned to flee from this place of shadowed peril to body and soul. As he turned, he saw whence had come the dark. A cloud had come up from its place on the horizon, the fat, sooty bank he had noted there at sundown, and now it obscured the moon. Poe paused in mid-retreat, gazing. His thoughtful eye gauged the speed and size of the cloud. It curtained the moon, would continue to curtain it for, well, 10 minutes. And for that 10 minutes, Elva Gauber would lie motionless, lifeless. She had told the truth about the moon giving her life. Hadn't she fallen like one slain on the stairs when they were darkened? Poe began grimly to string the evidence together. It was Elva Gauber, not her husband, who had died and gone to the family vault. She had come back to life, or a mockery of life, by touch of the moon's rays. Such light was an unpredictable force. It made dogs howl, it flogged madmen to violence, it brought fear or black sorrow or ecstasy. Old legends said that it was the birth of fairies, the transformation of werewolves, the motive power of broom-riding witches. It was surely the source of the strength and evil animating what had been the corpse of Elva Gobber, and he, Poe, must not stand there dreaming. He summoned all the courage that was his and scrambled in at the window through which clumped the woman's form. He groped across the room to the cellar door, opened it, and went down the stairs, through the door at the bottom, and into the stone-walled basement. It was dark, moonless still. Poe paused only to bring forth his tinderbox, strike a light, and kindle the end of a tightly twisted linen rag. It gave a feeble, steady light, and he found his way to the shutter, opened it, and touched the naked, wasted shoulder of John Gobber. "Get up," he said. "I've come to save you." The skull face feebly shifted its position to meet his gaze. The man managed to speak moaningly. "Useless! I can't move unless she lets me. Her eyes keep me here, half alive. I'd have died long ago, but somehow..." Poe thought of a wretched spider, paralyzed by the sting of a mud wasp, lying helpless in its captive's close den until the hour of feeding comes. He bent down, holding his blazing tinder close. He could see Gobber's neck, and it was a mass of tiny puncture wounds, some of them still beaded with blood drops fresh or dried. He winced, but bowed firm in his purpose. "Let me guess the truth," he said quickly. "Your wife was brought home from the grave, came back to a seeming of life. She put a spell on you, or played a trick, made you a helpless prisoner. That isn't contrary to nature, that last. I've studied mesmerism." "It's true," John Gobber mumbled. "And nightly she comes to drink your blood?" Gobber weakly nodded. "Yes, she was beginning just now, but ran upstairs. She will be coming back." "Good," said Poe bleakly. "Perhaps she will come back to more than she expects. Have you ever heard of vampires? Probably not, but I have studied them too. I began to guess, I think, when first she was so repelled by the odor of garlic. Vampires lie motionless by day and walk and feed at night. They are creatures of the moon. Their food is blood. Come." Poe broke off, put out his light, and lifted the man in his arms. Gobber was as light as a child. The writer carried him to the slanting shelter of the closed-in staircase, and there set him against the wall stones. The poor fellow would be well hidden. Next, Poe flung off his coat, waistcoat, and shirt. Heaping his clothing in a deeper shadow of the stairway, he stood up, stripped to the waist. His skin was almost as bloodlessly pale as Gobber's, his chest and arms almost as gaunt. He dared believe that he might pass momentarily for the unfortunate man. The cellar sprang full of light again. The cloud must be passing from the moon. Poe listened. There was a dragging sound above, then footsteps. Elva Gobber, the blood drinker by night, had revived. Now for it. Poe hurried to the niche, thrust himself in, and pulled the trapdoor shut after him. He grinned, sharing a horrid paradox with the blackness around him. He had heard all the fabled ways of destroying vampires. Transfixing stakes, holy water, prayer, fire, but he, Edgar Allan Poe, had evolved a new way. Myriads of tales whispered frighteningly of fiends lying in wait for normal men, but who had ever heard of a normal man lying in wait for a fiend? Well, he had never considered himself normal, in spirit, or brain, or taste. He stretched out, feet together, hands crossed on his bare midriff. Thus it would be in the tomb, he found himself thinking. To his mind came a snatch of poetry by a man named Bryant, published long ago in a New England review. "Breathless, darkness, and the narrow house." It was breathless and dark enough in this hole, heaven knew, and narrow as well. He rejected almost hysterically the implication of being buried. To break the ugly spell that daunted him, where thought of Elva Gobber failed, he turned sideways to face the wall, his naked arm lying across his cheek and temple. As his ear touched the musty bedding, it brought to him once again the echo of footsteps, footsteps descending the stairs. They were rhythmic, confident, they were eager. Elva Gobber was coming to seek again her interrupted repast. Now she was crossing the floor. She did not pause or turn aside. She had not noticed her husband lying under the cadet cloak in the shadow of the stairs. The noise came straight to the trap door, and he heard her fumbling for the latch. Light, blue as skimmed milk, poured into his nook. A shadow fell in the midst of it, full upon him. His imagination, ever outstripping reality, whispered that the shadow had weight, like lead, oppressive, baleful.
"John," said the voice of Elba Gobber in his ear, "I've come back. You know why. You know what for."
Her voice sounded greedy, as though it came through loose, trembling lips.
"You're my only source of strength now. I thought tonight that a stranger, but he got away. He had a cursed odor about him anyway."
Her hand touched the skin of his neck. She was prodding him, like a butcher fingering a doom.